fingers onto your palms. Or he'd capture skate tricks, backyard shows, or his crew hanging out in various parking lots across town. It cost $10 to develop, so he stockpiled the used-up cameras. When he turned 15, he got a job at a one-hour photo expressly to process them. Sam got to be a pretty good lab technician, though the job was unspeakably depressing. Only two types of people developed photos in those days: broke art kids and old weirdos. It was this fat 50-something dude, Bertie, who'd take pictures of himself and his Weimar on her. He was naked, and the dog wore waistcoats and hats, and they were photographed doing unseemly things, sitting at the dinner table with a full Thanksgiving spread, or slow dancing, the dog upright and impossibly long on its hindquarters. They recalled William Wegman's portraits, except with human full frontal, and though Sam didn't know exactly what was going on, he called the ASPCA anonymously and quit a week later. It was bleak. Sam was ready to move on to moving pictures anyway. He was on to janky VHS camcorders from the Goodwill after that. People were odd. Sam loved and loathed that about them. Fiction was fine, but real life was the true freak show. Sam's syllabus at ACC was spare, and he tried not to feel ripped off about it. 3 months to complete a project, a 22-minute short that would comprise most of his grade. He wouldn't get anywhere near the Blackmagic cinema cameras, since they required a $5,000 credit card deposit, but he was able to sign out an old Canon 5D Mark III with all the requisite lenses, some lavalier mics, and a better shotgun mic than he'd normally get his hands on, as well as a tripod. He also grabbed a tiny stabilizer rig for his iPhone in case he wanted something more run-and-gun. Finding a subject felt like a hunger that would never be satisfied. He'd glance at Finn, narrow his eyes, and wonder if there was something there.
In a world where a guy who was forever number two, the perfect wingman, the middle born of three sons, the dude who didn't get the girl and only got her slightly less attractive friend, finally...
Quit it, puto.
Finn flicked a piece of celery at him. Sam was halfway through soup prep for lunch.
What?
Seriously, said Finn. Your scheming face is scary as hell, especially when you're holding a knife.
Sam had tried making a movie about Lorraine on several occasions.
In a world where a beautiful rich girl with anger issues, who at her truest, most molten core only wants to be loved, discovers that...
But she'd catch him creep-shooting and blow her stack. As much as that girl loved a selfie, she wasn't big on other people controlling the final product. What he needed was a willing subject, someone as hungry as he was, someone who warranted a few minutes in the spotlight. Plenty of people craved attention. It had to be the right person, someone who naturally commanded it. Sam suspected most outwardly noisy people were boring on the inside, no more than the textbook swirl of insecurities and narcissism. Penny would make a fascinating subject, all that twitchy energy. Plus, what was up with her bags of stuff? He could shoot an unboxing video where she could unfurl her possessions and explain the thinking behind it all. It could serve as a legend for a map of her brain. Sam enjoyed texting Penny. They talked about work, sleep, food, random facts. It didn't need to be anything important. Their last text had been about what to eat for breakfast. Since Penny had seen him at his lowest, there was no reason to act cooler than he was. It felt easy, a bit like summer camp. Their texts had no bearing on their actual lives. It helped that she didn't seem to tire of him, no matter how dumb his questions.
Would you watch a documentary about a cat?
She texted back immediately.
Totally. Cats rule.
And then,
some are assholes, though.
There's this super cool guy that lives under our porch now.
What else?
That's pretty much it.
Okay, then maybe.
At 2:34 p.m., Sam had cleared the tables, wiped them down, and steam-cleaned the espresso machine. I have to make a documentary for a class.
Ah, ergo cat.
Sam enjoyed it as a response. Ergo cat. He couldn't call what his new friend would say next. He tried to remember the last time he'd slipped so easily into conversation without the added diversion of skateboarding or drinking or sex. Talks with Penny felt good, wholesome, normal, and curiously productive since they mostly discussed schoolwork. They were lab partners.
Emergency Penny, today, 6:01 p.m.
Would you read a short story on zombie food or nah?
Is this a legitimate concern of yours?
Maraschino cherries are the undead.
Okay, riveted. Please continue.
Perfectly healthy stone fruit are drowned in calcium chloride plus sulfur dioxide. Boom. Total ghost food. It's how come they're see-through.
I admit my interest is waning.
They gave me one on my pudding. Get it off. It's so gross. I can't touch it.
Today, 9:12 p.m. Hey.
Question mark?
What about a doc on a guy who's sick?
What kind of sick?
Terminal disease.
Yes.
Yes?
Sounds depressing AF. Into it, LOL. Healthcare is so messed up.
Sam wondered if Penny was super political or something. If she was aware of what was going on in the world outside her dorm. Sam was bad at politics, the same way he was bad at sports. It was all made up. The more yelling there was about it, the more it seemed like a distraction from what was really going on in the world.
Totally.
Sam googled American healthcare system to brush up.
It makes me sick, no pun intended. It's sad. We criminalize the poor. Everything is broken.
Okay, calm down.
Don't tell me to calm down.
I regret typing it. I'm sorry. I know girls hate that.
Everyone hates calm down, not just women. Don't say girls.
Okay. I'm sorry. Anyway, healthcare. What if the guy took matters into his own hands, drives to Mexico for drugs?
Go on.
He meets this other sick dude. They start a drug ring.
And?
They sell it to poor people, / downtrodden, / no healthcare.
OMG, is that the plot to Dallas Buyers Club?
Sam laughed in real life. Today, 1:45 a.m. Top 5 fave things in the world. Don't think about it, just type.
Isn't it a little late to be texting?
Shit, were you asleep?
No, but I could have been.
I can't sleep for shit lately.
Me neither. Okay, top 5. This feels like a trap.
It's not, I promise. No judgments. I don't know your life, your struggles, your journey.
Sam had been thinking about his favorites in bed. He loved the smell of the air before a thunderstorm, or how Texas weather was so crazy and the landscape so flat that you could see the driving rain in a clean, straight sheet when everything that lay ahead of it was sunny. Pringles.
Pringles?
Sorry, I'm eating Pringles. They're so good. When's the last time you had a Pringle? I forgot about them. I'd miss them when I'm dead.
You'd miss Pringles when you're dead?
You said no judgment.
Wow.
Well?
I guess it's too late for texting, but not for Pringles.
It's never too late for Pringles.
Then Sam texted Lorraine. 5 weeks late and counting. Last time they'd talked, she promised to get a blood test, and that was almost a week ago. She'd been flaky when they were together, but he couldn't believe she'd leave him hanging about such a huge deal. This was literally life or death. Bad enough that Lorraine often said literally when she meant figuratively.
Sam stared at the screen, willing a bubble to appear.
Zip.
Penny. Is this sheer? Penny stood in front of the mirror in a white, knee-length cotton dress. Only when you're backlit. Is it slutty? Jude scoffed, an odd sound between a bleat and a laugh. I don't think you're capable of slutty, she said, sitting up in bed. I mean, she continued, you're wearing virginal white. Penny had chosen a summery sheath for her first date back with Mark. She wanted him to see her in color. Not that white was a color, necessarily, but black extra wasn't, and she didn't want to appear too funereal. If she was going to break up with a guy, she wanted to look good. Maybe her best. Humans were garbage like that. Is an official breakup necessary? Asked Jude. I mean, you're in college, he's not. Everybody knows what that means. Jude jokingly jerked off the air and mimed spraying the result into the sky. Ew, said Penny, screwing her face. Listen, no shade, Jude continued, laughing. I don't know your Tinder habits. Her roommate nodded pointedly at the phone in Penny's hand. Penny smiled tightly. Right then, she and Sam were locked in a contest of who could capture the most boringly predictable Instagram photo. He'd just sent the most glorious sunset, hashtag no filter. Penny was dying to send back one taken from her car of someone posing in front of the Hi, How Are You Frog mural on 21st Street while wearing a Hi, How Are You Frog mural t-shirt. It was meta and brilliant and a surefire winner, except she first had to bumble through this awkward date with Mark first to feel proper triumph. Penny couldn't wait for it to be over. A breakup made sense. Anthropologically, she and Mark were incompatible. When they were dating, they only ever hung out one-on-one at each other's houses to watch TV and make out. It was more a middle school relationship than a real thing, and when he went to parties with his friends, it was understood she wouldn't accompany him. It suited them both most of the time. If anything, Penny was grateful he wasn't big on conversation. She didn't even know how to explain their arrangement to herself. The plan was to drive home, see Mark, end it, and drive back. Celeste, she'd deal with another time. Penny wasn't in the mood to bond and chin-wag about boys and console her mother under the pretense of commiseration. This was between her and Mark. Penny wondered if she was nervous and promptly yawned. Just as she cried when she was mad, she needed a nap when faced with anxiety. It wasn't that she was disinterested, it's that she became overwhelmed, went into overdrive, and shut down. Thing is, Penny hadn't meant to blow everyone off, and she would have passed a polygraph when asked about it. She'd been meaning to go home the first weekend, or else the second, undoubtedly the third. By now, more than a month later, the natives were restless and thinking about it made Penny sleepy. In the short while she'd been at college, a seemingly negligible sliver of time, her brain reset. The routine rhythms of her old life were booted from her operating system. Sure, she missed having kimchi in the fridge or a Costco stash of triple-ply toilet paper stored above a washer and dryer you could operate for free, but whenever her mother texted or when Mark called, the interruption was staggering. Mind-blowing. She may as well have been getting messages from the spirit world. It was inconceivable that both college and home operated on the same space-time. Exhibit A from Celeste. OMG, P, I saw this girl on the street who I thought was you, but she was way fatter. What are you supposed to say to that? Thanks. Exhibit B, from Mark. I got Rutherford for BizCalc. Isn't Rutherford the only BC teacher? Yeah, sucks. Yeah, sucks. Sucks. Or this phone call from Mark. Baby, I missed you today. Me too. He missed you too. Who? Oh. Mark talked about his penis in the third person. It struck Penny as the least romantic way to broach the subject, and every time he came up, Penny pictured a penis wearing sunglasses and a fedora with a little jacket. It's not as if Penny could blame him. Mark was a red-blooded male in a committed relationship with a college girl, hence sexed to initiate sex. College people had sex, especially people who had been dating for however many months they'd been dating. Penny counted back on her hands. It was 7. 7 whole months. 7 times longer than how long she'd been gone. It wasn't as if she didn't want to have sex. She did, in theory. She'd tried going through with it once, with Mark, pretty early on, because honestly, why else would Mark go for Penny if not to have regular relationship sex? In the end, she'd gotten as far as getting naked with some fumbling third base action, until the dread came, a sticky inkiness that crept up her neck and swallowed her head whole. They'd maneuvered into a facilitating position, and Penny started crying silently, which she didn't realize she was doing until it scared him and he stopped. She fell asleep soon after. And get this. They never talked about it. Penny had braced herself for a confrontation, but it simply never happened. Through the summer, however, he'd been coming up more frequently. Penny pulled up at Jim's, a diner with a red roof, cheap coffee, and surprisingly good soup. She was grateful most of the Saturday morning crowd had cleared out. Mark kept hinting that they could go back to his house after lunch, except that Penny was pretty sure they wouldn't be seeing a movie after their talk. God, unless they did. Penny could actually imagine amicably watching the new Avengers movie after the breakup and then heading home. Mark was already seated when she arrived. The way his eyes lit up as she opened the door sent a small wave of revulsion through her. "Hi, baby." He stood from the booth, hugged her, and, horror, handed her a single red rose. It was wrapped in cellophane, and it appeared as if it had spent some time living in a Circle K. Penny smiled, took the flower, hesitated, then drew her nose to it. It smelled of printer cartridges.
"It's stupid," said Mark tenderly.
He was wearing a powder blue dress shirt and silver basketball shorts with flip-flops.
"But I wanted to get you something."
He was nervous, which made her nervous. Any established couple within stone's throw would have cringed in sympathy.
"You hate it, don't you?"
he asked tentatively. "No, it's great." Penny thought of the box of chocolates that the mailman had given her mom.
"You look beautiful," he said, admiring her dress. "I don't know that I've ever seen you not wearing black."
Penny smiled stiffly.
Yeah. Thanks.
They ordered tortilla soup for her, biscuits with sausage gravy for him.
"Not that I don't love you in black,"
he said quickly, handing his plastic menu to their server.
"I love you in anything."
Penny prayed he didn't follow with,
"I'd love you out of anything. Heh heh."
On their first night sharing a room, at the mention of a boyfriend, Jude had set up a system. She would sleep at Mal's if Penny needed, in Jude's words, a conjugal visit. Jude had rabbited the air quotes wearing this ridiculous smirk. Penny threw a pillow at her. She could imagine such a visit. First, she pictured Mark naked. That part was easy, not entirely unpleasant. Then she imagined his pressure on top of her, mashing her, grinding away with that well-meaning smile, calling her baby, 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 while she became catatonic and wanted to drown. See, she could imagine it. She just couldn't imagine wanting it. Penny wanted to be normal. She was 18, for Christ's sake, a respectable age to start having healthy, consensual sex. Sexy sex with someone sexy. Penny's mind went to Sam. Tattoos, scowl, crinkly-eyed laugh. She thought about his veiny, inked arms would feel encircling her body. The heat emanating from his chest. How he would smell. It was the most pornographic scenario her mind had mustered in public. Still, she wasn't breaking up with Mark because of Sam. At least, not in the sense that Mark was the only thing standing in the way of her and Sam being together. That was nuts. It was more that Sam was the type of human Penny couldn't have previously fathomed. Sam was proof of life on other planets. If a Sam existed, she couldn't be with a Mark. Not even if she couldn't be with a Sam. To Penny, it made perfect sense. Their food came. They both ordered wet food. It was a tactical error. Penny wasn't in the mood for wet food, eating it or observing it. Mark's plate glistened under a thick blanket of creamy, greasy white gravy. Penny thought about how it would form a skin if left to cool. Penny watched Mark use the back of his fork to mash the bits of sausage into the biscuit and the sauce into a kind of paste. Her small bowl of watery broth with chips floating on top and sprigs of green didn't look so great either.
"Oh no, baby," he lamented. "You forgot to ask for no cilantro. Want me to send it back? We'll tell them you're allergic."
Penny peered down at the offending frond. Did Mark hate cilantro? She had no idea.
His deep concern about the situation was written on his features, his thin upper lip lending an air of determination to his childlike face. Penny wondered if Mark was capable of physically hurting her. Or if he'd cry. She wondered how mad his mad could get. Penny couldn't take it anymore. "We should break up," she said. He stared at her uncomprehending for a moment, then recoiled as if he'd been struck. His eyebrows scrambled skyward to his hairline. They didn't watch Avengers. "You're back early." Jude barely looked up from her laptop. She was sprawled on the floor with an apple core lying on the carpet beside her. "Did he like your dress?" "Yeah," said Penny, walking into the bathroom. Jude followed, continuing to talk to her from the other side of the door. "I called my dad." "Yeah?" "I couldn't bring myself to tell him about changing my major, though." Penny sighed and washed her face. She unzipped the dress and pulled on her robe. "You know," said Jude, repositioning herself on Penny's bed, "for the record, I think you could absolutely look slutty if you wanted to." Penny laughed. "Are you okay?" "I'm fine," Penny said. "Did Mark get mad?" "Yeah." Mark had been enraged. In fact, he'd been so angry that it was the first time Penny had thought he seemed truly masculine. Penny didn't need Dr. Green to tell her how messed up that was. When Mark let her have it, she zoned out. He'd called her a freak, which hardly qualified as observant. Penny yawned. "What else?" asked Jude warily. He then started crying about how the same thing had happened with his ex. His Asian ex, Penny thought. He ordered biscuits and sausage gravy. And? It was gruesome. What was gruesome? Biscuits and gravy. I don't understand it as a food unit. It's the most disgusting concept, she said. Congealed drippings over globs of flour and butter. How could anyone eat that in public? Wow, said Jude, staring at her. Penny stared back at Jude. I ask you about a personal trauma, and you tell me about the catering? Penny nodded. You're bad at this. Penny nodded again. You need therapy. Penny nodded a third time. Are you sad? She was. Yeah. You know you can tell me anything, said Jude. Penny regarded her roommate's big, sorrowful eyes and knew it to be true. I'm going to hug you now, Jude warned. Penny nodded. The pressure felt good.
Sam. Sam stared at himself in the mirror of the medicine cabinet. He was wearing his second nicest button-up, a white dress shirt that he typically saved for weddings or funerals. His first nicest was the Ralph Lauren Lorraine had gotten him two Christmases ago, but he didn't want to wear it. He didn't want to remind her of the other memory, how he'd gotten her a bracelet so cheap it turned her wrist green. Sam buttoned the shirt all the way to the top, then unbuttoned the top button, and then buttoned it again. He sighed. He looked like a LinkedIn profile pic. It wasn't a date or anything. You can't actually date someone you used to date and vowed to never date again. No way Lorraine would call it a date. Yet when she texted him for dinner upon ignoring his texts, he was nervous. She probably had something awful to tell him. On the upside, he hadn't had any panic attacks since the first, and he imagined his body was saving up for just such an occasion. Sam pictured himself stumbling in slow-mo through the dining room of Mother's Italian restaurant, grabbing tables for support, sending plates of tagliatelle crashing to the floor. He'd ruin Liar's expensive dress and wouldn't hear the end of it. Sam wanted to shoot a selfie to Penny for outfit approval, except they didn't do that sort of thing. As if she could sense him thinking about her, Penny texted him. Should I read Harry Potter from the beginning again? He took a selfie in the bathroom mirror and sent it to her. She wrote back, and then,
So I should read them, or... Okay. Wait. Did you do that on purpose? I need advice. Help me. Okay. Take the plea deal. Ask me something else. My advice, RN, is en fuego. Stop. Wait. So you don't have a court date? I'm seeing Lorraine. Penny fell silent. Bubble. Then no bubble. So he wrote, "It's not a date." Sam didn't know why he was explaining himself. After a long moment, she responded, "So no bowling or putt-putt?" "Ice skating, then karaoke, waterfall picnic at dusk." "Very cool. P.S. Hayrides greater than karaoke. Don't forget flowers. Carnations. No, a corsage." "Dinner. Just dinner. I want to die." "Why die?" "Probably have a panic attack." "Calm down." "Ha. So shirt, Y/N? "Shirt seems desperate. Dress regular." "So orange bell-bottoms?" "Yeah, and pink Uggs." "Please delete this photo." "Never. Send nudes." Sam took off the shirt and grabbed a black t-shirt. The blue veins coursed along his body like tributaries until they disappeared under the indelible black tattoos that his friends had carved into him. He had 16 in all. Several crappy stick and pokes, crossed arrows, diamonds, snails, hands, and hamsas to ward off evil eyes, and the rest from an artist whose house he'd painted in exchange for 20 hours in his chair. He stared at his chest, curving his shoulders inward and creating a golf ball-sized divot on his sternum. For a brief period during sophomore year, he'd tried to gain weight, filling gallon plastic jugs of water and using them as dumbbells, hoisting them above his head over and over in front of the mirror. The hopeful determination in his reflection as he stood in his underwear was embarrassing even in memory. Growing up, the problem wasn't so much the lack of strength training as it was food. Groceries were scarce, and money for school lunches was a non-starter. Brandy Rose, who was not above collecting workman's comp on dubious grounds, was somehow too proud to fill out the paperwork for her son's need-based meals. "We don't do handouts," she'd say. By junior year, Sam said the hell with it and forged the paperwork himself. At first he'd gotten the tattoos to create a diversion from his slight frame. But now he no longer hated his body. It was tidy, contained, efficient. Though Penny would probably be horrified if she ever did see him with his clothes off. Objectively, his body was alarming. Sam picked Lorraine up in Finn's Ford Festiva slightly before 8. It was a mud-brown 14-year-old beater that was so rusted through you could lift the mat on the driver's side and watch the highway rush by from a quarter-sized peephole. Sam buzzed at the gate as she'd requested. "Hey," she said. She wore what she usually did when she was off work, a somewhat abbreviated version of a nightie. Lorraine. Lore. Lore. Or Lola, as she called herself lately, though Sam never did. He could practically feel his pupils dilate when he saw her. "Nice dress," he said when she opened the door to his car. He wondered if he should have gotten out and opened it for her, though she would have made fun of him for it. It wasn't as if she were infirm.
Thanks for picking me up."
She pulled him in for a hug. It was an awkward sideways embrace where you're both sitting down and the non-hugging arm gets mashed, but still, it knocked the wind out of him. As was customary for when he saw her, he felt his thoughts go all soft and watery. She smelled so good, exactly the way she was supposed to. He knew every bit of real estate on her body. He thought about her feet again. Lorraine pulled away and started laughing.
"This is so absurd," she said, putting her seatbelt on. "I can't believe Finn loaned you his car."
She looked into the back seat and wrinkled her nose.
"I could have picked you up."
"Where's the fun in that?" Sam partially regretted leaving Finn's empty soda bottles in the back seat, even if he'd done it on purpose. This was not a date. By the time Sam pulled up at Mother's, a spot far enough off campus that it wasn't overrun with students, they'd exhausted small talk. And when Sam got her door, she didn't make too big a deal out of it. She thanked him primly and touched his forearm. They slid into the deep, padded booth. On their early dates, they were the annoying couple that sat on the same side, whispering, canoodling, picking up bits of food to feed each other like lovesick birds.
"Do you want to split the ziti and the sausage and peppers?" Lorraine asked, scanning the menu.
Sam had been dreaming about meatballs, yet he found himself shrugging.
"Sure."
Sam remembered why they shared food whenever they went out. Lorraine would order the two things she wanted and strong-armed him into wanting them as well.
"Are you sure you don't want to get a vegetable or a salad?" he asked, eyeing the sides. "Something with folate?"
Lorraine peered over the leather-bound wine list.
"Sam, what is folate?"
"It's in broccoli," he said. "Pregnant ladies have to take it so the baby's spine doesn't grow outside of their bodies. Don't do an image search. It's upsetting." She laughed.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I shouldn't laugh."
Lorraine picked up a piece of focaccia, dipped it in olive oil, and took a bite, chewing slowly. She crossed her arms, and Sam noticed the glint of a new charm bracelet on her wrist. It was visibly expensive, crowded with ornate silver beads and intricate replicas of what appeared to be shoes. He wondered who'd bought it for her.
"How are you, Lore?" he asked.
What he wanted to ask her was, "Do you miss me?" But it didn't quite seem the right time. Maybe after tiramisu. Sam also really wanted to ask what all of this was about. Whether she'd had her appointment and discovered complications. Why else would she not have texted him back?
"Before you light into me," she began, "I haven't gone to the clinic yet."
He couldn't believe it.
"What? Why?"
"I couldn't make it," she said, snapping a breadstick in half. "It was insane at work, but I made an appointment for tomorrow. I'm going tomorrow." Sam couldn't believe how cavalier she was being. Period lateness count, 7 weeks.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
I couldn't deal. She crumbled the rest of the breadstick onto the tablecloth.
"Well, you're going to have to deal with this," he said. "We're going to have to deal."
"I know," she said. "I know this makes no sense, but I don't think I'm pregnant. I don't feel pregnant." Sam studied Lorraine for any physical differences. He took a quick peek at her boobs, and they appeared about the same.
"Are you checking me out to see if I look knocked up?"
"Yes." "No," he told her. The waiter came around.
Yeah, we're going to split the ziti and the... Man, he definitely wanted meatballs.
"Sausage and peppers," she finished. "And a glass of Merlot," said Lorraine. She pulled out her driver's license.
"I guess you really don't feel pregnant, huh?" he asked, once the waiter had left.
Lorraine rolled her eyes. "French women drink up until the very end," she said.
"French women also eat horse," said Sam under his breath.
"What?" Lorraine asked.
"Nothing."
"I take it you're not drinking lately?" She leaned back into the booth.
"No," said Sam, leaning in. "Haven't since all of this happened," he said, stirring the sky with his forefinger.
"Understandable. The smell of gin still turns my stomach," Lorraine shuddered.
Shameful scenes from their breakup slammed into Sam's head, the two of them screaming in the street after his debit card stopped working. She'd called him a bum like his father, and he'd called her a duplicitous bitch.
"Lore, why'd you ask me here?"
"Well, you picked the restaurant," she said, smiling sweetly.
"Lorraine?"
"I don't know," she said, averting her gaze. "I thought it would be nice."
Lorraine snapped another breadstick into ever smaller pieces and arranged them on the table. He braced himself for the news that they were having twins, or that she was engaged to someone else.
"That's it? Really?" he asked.
"No news?"
She shook her head.
Sam couldn't believe he'd had to ask for an advance on his paycheck for this.
"You know what?" he said after a while.
She glanced up at him.
"Let's create a pact."
"A pact," she repeated.
Lorraine reached for another breadstick to pulverize. He took it from her. Wasted food made him crazy.
"Yeah," he said.
"The pact is we'll table everything serious for the duration of the meal, and you and me will catch up."
Lorraine's wine arrived.
"We don't have to talk about the other stuff."
"Deal," she said. She raised her glass in a toast and took a sip. Sam wanted to excuse himself to look up fetal alcohol syndrome statistics, but couldn't in the spirit of the pact.
Stupid pact.
"So," said Lorraine,
What I want to know is... She paused.
What?
Never mind, she said. No, tell me. Where have you been living?
Sam blinked.
Near campus, he said.
Where near campus?
Off Guadalupe, he said. A partial lie at worst.
Why the Spanish Inquisition? He asked, trying to keep his tone light.
Their pasta dishes landed on the table with a thud as Sam decided he wasn't hungry. The ziti looked dry. Eat and switch? She asked. And don't worry, dinner's on me.
Sam nodded and handed her the sausage first. She inevitably wanted the sausage first so she could pick out the crispy ends, the best parts.
Well, Lorraine tried again, I know you're not living in your car unless you're sleeping out of fins, which I obviously don't envy.
Sam's cheeks burned. Lorraine had a habit of kidding in a way that made you want to walk off a bridge.
And I talked to Gunnar and Gash, so I know you're not living with them.
Sam used to see Gunnar and his cousin Ash, a.k.a. Gash, 5 nights a week. He fell silent.
How's school? She asked after a while.
Sam shoveled a forkful of pasta into his mouth to mull over the answer. He nodded while he chewed. Why was Lorraine on a fact-finding mission?
Good, he swallowed. I'm taking a film course at ACC and it's fine. A lot of freedom. I'm shooting a documentary.
Finally, she said, picking at her meal. Isn't it expensive?
It ain't cheap, he said. But you can borrow gear, and if all else fails, I've got my phone. I'll shoot it fast and dirty.
Well, that suits you, she said.
What the hell did that mean?
They ate in silence.
Your turn, said Sam, working to keep his tone even. How's the job?
Job's good, she said. I got a raise. Nothing to write home about. Hopefully a promotion's next. I'll probably be a junior account manager by next year, which is what I want. I'll get to travel to L.A.
That's great, he said. He realized he meant it. Traveling for work was the height of glamour as far as Lorraine was concerned.
And I love the people I work with, she said. They're young and fun to hang out with. You'd think they're corny.
Sam immediately thought about Paul again. He had no idea what he looked like, not that it mattered. Sam could imagine his type exactly. He envisioned Lorraine celebrating her promotion over $18 cocktails with some douchebag with a big shiny watch and buffed square fingernails. He probably plucked his eyebrows and bleached his enormous capped teeth. He thought back to when he and Lorraine met, when she described herself first and foremost as a DJ. He'd since learned most DJs or comedians or musicians were artists by the grace of their parents' financial support.
Sausage?
Sam nodded. The plate of oily meat and tangles of peppers and onions made him queasy. Or perhaps it was something else.
Laura, what happened to us?
Lorraine laughed dryly and took another sip of wine.
So much for the pact.
Well, he said, we make up and break up without talking about what actually happened.
What are you asking me, Sam?
It doesn't make sense to me, he said. Why we're not together?
Lorraine put her fork down and sighed.
We don't make sense, she said, as if that explained anything.
How can you say that?
Sam suddenly wished he'd ordered a glass of wine, or a box.
We're not friends, she said.
Sam felt the dull thud of her words in his sternum. It took all of his composure to maintain eye contact. He scrunched his napkin under the table.
We were these lunatic hotheads that fought and made up, Lorraine continued. You'd scream and cry, I'd want to get it over with, and that was that.
Sam couldn't stand the way she distilled their relationship to the plot of a formulaic rom-com, or as if she were wearing a white coat and chuckling about the mating lab rats she kept under observation.
You say that like there weren't truly beautiful moments, he muttered into his food. We loved each other.
I know we did, she said. She took his hand in hers with a tender smile playing on her lips as though she were bargaining with a child.
I still love you in a way. I swear to God, Sam, sometimes you were so good at literally reading my mind.
Sam pictured Lorraine cracking his skull open and reading his brain grooves, literally, like Braille.
But we were together for 4 years, she continued, and you didn't make an effort to get to know me or my family. At the mention of family, Sam stiffened. He wasn't big on the Mastersons. He recalled the abysmal Easter when he'd had dinner with them at Chez Jumel.
Oh, you mean the time your racist dad asked me if I had any Middle Eastern blood so he'd have a real reason to hate me?
Lorraine removed her hand from his.
No, he didn't, she said.
He sure did, he said. Not that it made a difference. The night was awash from the get-go. The Capital Metro bus strike happened at the last minute, and Sam arrived straight from work in a bleach-stained black flag t-shirt.
I don't know, she said. You were outright hostile toward them. It's hardly my parents' fault that they're well off. They work like demons.
She said this plainly, as if there were no privileges inherent in being land-rich by pedigree for generations. A distant relative on her mom's side, C.E. Doolin, had also happened to invent the Frito. Rather, he'd happened to buy the recipe for a song from the Mexican man who'd invented it.
It's not as if it were some great secret that you were, she gazed up at him, not well off.
She miraculously sidestepped calling him poor.
Your clothes are a dead giveaway.
Sam chewed on the inside of his cheek. Lorraine went on cataloging his shortcomings between bites of food. Sam was a romantic, no doubt, and these were parts of their relationship he'd forgotten about, the comparisons. Sam wanted to get up, calmly set his napkin down, and sprint out into the night.
Hey, said Lorraine, poking his hand. I'm just joshing.
Partly. Sam didn't think so. He took another bite as his stomach roiled. Though mercifully, he didn't pass out.
Penny. Writing is the art of applying the seat of the pants to the seat of the chair. Mary Heaton Vorse. Penny got up at 5:15 a.m. No matter when she closed her eyes, they snapped open before 6. These days, it was a blessing, seeing as she needed a quiet moment to write. She hadn't had to do that before, find time. And she wondered lately if tapping out little blue bubbles to Sam was somehow sucking her inspiration well dry. Penny feared that she'd used up her best stuff on him, and her mind wandered constantly. It didn't help that a pert little antenna stayed vigilantly trained on her phone, scanning the airwaves to see if he needed company or was having a mini-crisis. Penny threw on a sweatshirt and cracked open her laptop. Henry Miller, whose middle name was Valentine and who, when he died, was married to a Japanese woman, said, "Write first and always. Painting, music, friends, cinema, all these come afterward." Penny wondered where marrying came in, considering Miller had 5 wives. She also wondered where workshopping Sam's drama fell in terms of priorities. For Penny, it was sizing up to be text first. And always. Sam House, Sunday, 4:14 p.m. What do you love about your writing class? Nothing. I hate it. Also, I love it. Obs. Say more. Okay. Penny cracked her knuckles. She'd hooked up iMessage to her laptop so she could type as much as she wanted without her fingers falling off. It's as close as I've ever gotten to feeling like a writer, a real one. You sit there and you have to do it. Everyone is capable of putting words down or telling a story, but not everyone will actually do it. This class is about the doing and getting better. Feels professional. Not like a normal college class where you learn things you'll never apply. Sam didn't say anything. No thought bubble, no interruption, no nothing. Penny went on. You know how you can make a sound on a piano? Anyone with fingers can do it. Intuitive, you hit keys, they make noise. Writing and reading, then rewriting, and then editing is how you make a melody. It's the same for everyone. It's not about raw talent or having such a big ego that you think what you have to say is so important or who your parents are and what they do. It's the practice of it. Doing it until you're good. And then, because she felt self-conscious, does that make sense? Totally. And I get it. What do you hate about it? Penny started writing back, and then stopped. She took another stab at it. It's so hard. It hurts my feelings, it's so hard. And it's scary. Ah ha ha. Well, yeah.
guess that's what makes it worth doing. It's as scary as you can get. Writers die trying. Do you call yourself a writer? Ew, no. Why ew? I feel like a fraud. Yeah, imposter syndrome. Penny Googled imposter syndrome. Informally used to describe people who are unable to internalize their accomplishments despite external evidence of their competence. It can mess you up, for sure. It undoubtedly applied to her. I just... ... She tried again. I haven't ever seen a writer, a big deal writer, who looks like me. And sometimes when I write, I imagine the hero is white, like, automatically. How fucked is that? Penny stopped. She'd never told anyone that before. She wondered how that worked in movies. She wrote back. Why do you want to make movies? Ugh, IDK. Ever think you'll jinx it when you talk about it? Yes. Deaf have imposter syndrome. Making movies is for rich people. It's so ridiculous to say you want to be a director. May as well say you want to be in the NBA, or famous. Or the inventor of an app. Right. The app that invents apps. Penny smiled. So you want to be a writer, and I want to make movies. Feels corny to say out loud. But that's okay. It's important to at least admit it to yourself and to a few trusted people. Your emergency contact, for example. LOL, exactly. Then you make it real. Penny loved how unselfconsciously he said that. From anyone else, it would sound self-helpy. P.S. I want to read your work someday. Only if I get to see your movie. Fat chance. Penny laughed. There was no way she was going to let Sam read anything she wrote. J.A. didn't count, since she was her professor, and neither did the kids in class. Everyone's guts were splayed out on the table. It was mutually assured destruction. One time Jude tried to read over Penny's shoulder, and she'd been apoplectic. The terrors lay cold and caged at the bottom of the deep? Jude! Penny shrieked, slamming her laptop shut. You can't do that. It's a gross invasion of privacy. Penny sprang up out of her chair, clutching her computer to her chest. Whoa! Said Jude, big-eyed. Holy shit, I'm sorry. I didn't know you'd wig. Don't you think you should get used to someone reading it since the eventual goal is public consumption? She had a point. But Penny was scared of what her stories revealed. The constructive criticism from class, even on the tiniest points, ruined her day, and Jude was enough in her business without getting access to Penny's thoughts as well. For her final, she was plotting out a story inspired by the true events of a Korean couple that accidentally neglected their baby to death. It was all over the papers in Korea, and the sad part was that it happened because the parents were obsessively playing a video game where the whole point, of all things, was to raise a child. Their real-life baby's name was Sarang, which means love in Korean. Everything about the story was tragic and fascinating, and for class, Penny wanted to write two narratives, story A from the viewpoint of the mom, and B from the perspective of the baby in the video game. It was a story within a story, the way Watchmen contained Tales of the Black Freighter, a comic about pirates. Penny was enthralled by the origami of the form, except she couldn't figure it out. Write one first, or both at the same time? In class, the story confused everyone. Is the main character the Tamagotchi baby or the mom? Asked Maya. Maya was the mixed girl who'd talked about Kardashian hair on the first day and was writing a ghost story about the Santa Ana winds. Both, Penny said. And it's not a Tamagotchi, it's a Sims baby or a clan in Clash of the Clans. Whatever, said Maya. They're both wicked unlikable. Oh, because a weather phenomenon that's on a murder spree is so likable, retorted Andy, the British Chinese kid. Penny shot him a grateful look. He smiled. Penny didn't know what was so hard about sympathizing with a computer-generated video game character or a Korean woman, but that seemed to be the general consensus.
Penny started out with a mother talking to her lawyer. That much she felt was solid. It was a secure, accessible place from which to world build. She figured she'd lull the reader into a false sense of security, begin as Law and Order that transmogrifies into the Matrix without warning. She made herself a cup of tea, sat back down, and tried to imagine the woman's appearance. Penny began by picturing her hair. Did Korean women get soccer mom haircuts? Penny settled on giving the mom a bob and dressed her in a gray maternity dress. According to the papers, she was pregnant again by the time she and her husband were sentenced. What did this woman want? Did she feel bad? How bad? As bad as you should if you ignore your baby to death? How engrossing can a video game be that you forget your baby? I am not a bad mother, said the wife. Mrs. Kim was subdued, with no makeup, and her lips were chapped. Her hand shook as she drank from the white paper cup. She was diminutive and of indeterminate age. As he flipped through her file, he saw she was younger than her husband by 20 years. She'd gone to a good school, yet had never held down a job. Mrs. Kim met her husband at an internet cafe, and according to witnesses, they were affectionate and companionable. I'm not a bad mother, she repeated in a daze. I loved my babies more than anything. She took a sharp intake of breath and corrected herself. Baby. The lawyer glanced up from his notes. The wife's chin trembled. He jotted down that she still considered the video game baby to be real. J.A. advised the class on voice and how a good way to work through a story was to make it sound as if you were explaining it to a friend over email. Penny figured texting was as good. Sam House, yesterday, 1:13 a.m. Wait, hold on. I want to ask you something. Don't be offended. Ha ha, does that ever work? Nope. Fine, say it. Be nice, though. Writers are sensitive. How does your story count as fiction? This woman exists. The couple's real. Sam found a documentary on the couple, and they'd watched it together. Not in the same room, just at the same time while texting. Every article and TV segment treated them as though they were internet oddities or space aliens. The documentary in particular may as well have been about talking dogs the way they presented the parents. Penny wondered if the perverse fascination would have been as extreme if it had happened in America. A country, by the way, where a guy in Minnesota tried to raise his kid to speak Klingon. That's why I want to write about the baby in the video game as well. That's the fiction part, the fantasy. Does the baby inside know that the real baby is dying? IDK if the video game baby cares, collateral damage, etc. Jesus, that's dark. Is it, though? VG baby lives in constant violence. That's why SF's the greatest. You make the rules. San Francisco? No, dork, science fiction. Said the dork who caps locks science fiction. Ha 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 ha, fair. I like this. I can't wait to find out what video game baby wants. Penny couldn't either. J.A.'s homework schedule was no joke. Every week, there was a new short story due, and for those, Penny wrote about squirrel crime mobs, post-apocalyptic plagues that only took out people over 19, colleges in the future where the entrance exams were assassinations, and a Buddhist who died and came back as a toy. Building a world where you rappel in, set up some characters, and ejector seat your way out was a breeze. J.A. had no patience for Breezy, and when she called Penny in for office hours, she told her as much. Her teacher's room was filled with succulents and rainbow glass planters, and Penny halfway expected her teacher to extend an offer of friendship. She was so pleased with her last story. It was about a crew of powerful moguls and politicians who were set adrift in a spaceship since the planet they were destined for wasn't where they'd thought it would be. The astrophysicist eggheads they'd left behind had been wrong. These men were the 1% of the 1% who had abandoned the rest of civilization, and still their billions couldn't save them. The universe had told them the first no of their lives, and the fight scene was hilarious. "These are great," J.A. began. "But..." Penny hadn't been expecting a but. She braced herself. "They're rhythmically one note," J.A. continued. "You're inventive and funny. That's clear on the page. I want you to work on character motivation. I can't invest in protagonists when I don't know what they want, and just as important, why they want it." Penny felt color rising on her neck. That wasn't fair. It was clear what the men in the spaceship wanted. "They want their planet," Penny said. She cringed at the whiny pitch she was taking. "Well, yes," continued J.A., "they all want that. Humans want to live, that's a given. The issue is they want the same thing in the same way, and that's a missed opportunity. You've got world leaders here. They're captains of industry. They're singular men, but look." J.A. circled some passages. "They speak the same. I'm only picking on you because your excellent dialogue and glitter bomb observations won't save you for the final." It was clear Penny's sweet spot was 2 or 3 pages. The last story they'd had to write was 20,000 words, longer than anything she'd ever written. Penny usually wrote to escape, so her worlds were fantastic and, well, apparently one note. Penny thought she knew what her characters wanted. It was trickier to deduce why they wanted anything, and a different proposition entirely to say how they'd get it. Hell, Penny had no idea what she wanted. Why would her inventions fare any better? Plus, there were so many distractions. Ergo, getting up at 5:15 this morning. Penny planned to hammer out her 3 acts, handwritten on note cards so she could visualize scenes and move them around. Except that as she fanned out her color-coded 3x5s, she realized that her nails were disgusting. The puny chips of lacquer were sad little archipelagos of poison that were probably falling into her food. She took out the nail kit her mom got her as a stocking stuffer every Christmas and removed the polish. Penny didn't want to admit how much she resembled her mother in these moments. It was classic Celeste to do nails instead of what she was supposed to be doing. It struck Penny that she missed Celeste at the oddest times, often the most baffling parts of her, too. The way her mom's ribcage felt when she hugged her from behind, or how the curly hair of her econ prof reminded her so much of Celeste during lectures. If only there were a way of seeing her mom without either of them having to talk. When Penny's nails were bare, she figured she should wash her hair. There was nothing worse than ruining a fresh manicure with an ill-timed shower. While Penny stood under the spray, she noticed that because their dorm bathroom didn't have a window, a thin layer of mildew had formed in the caulk. That itself was tolerable, except then mold was a foregone conclusion, and that stuff could kill you. An hour and a half later, she was clean, the shower stall was spotless, her nails were a matte slate gray, and she was ready. She put pants on so she could apply the seat of them to the chair. This is what she had so far. The baby in the game was known as an anima, so she wrote down anima. Then she Wikipedia'd it, since that's the first order of business when you don't know what the hell you're doing. Anima meant soul, or animating principle. According to the psychologist Carl Jung, anima also implied the unseen individual, the true inner self. Penny didn't have a ton of experience playing online role-playing games like the one in the story. She knew, though, that Overwatch and World of Warcraft were huge in Korea, PC games that were played so competitively and obsessively that tournaments filled arenas and people went into rehab for addiction. Regardless, what was true of all games was that there had to be a task, a pursuit. So she wrote down Quest in her favorite ultra-fine rollerball black pen. God, she loved that word. She underlined Quest. Such a euphonic word. Quest. Ooh, Odyssey was a good word too, but she'd already underlined Quest. she added a question mark. Then she took out another note card and simply wrote, "How does the hero get what they want?" J.A.'s words nagged at her. First, Penny had to set up the rules. The main part of the game was that the hero or the player character had to raise a baby or the anima. The anima was the trusted sidekick, and you could dress them up and give them weapons, but most importantly,